Welcome, everyone, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Vowdern, and with me is my co-host, the warrior of the wasteland and the Ayatollah of rock and rolla, Mr. Barry Rose. Barry, how are you doing today?
Jesus, am I doing great. It is, you know, we've been doing this show now. We are past the six-month mark, and today it is 70 degrees outside in Philadelphia. The sun is shining. It's just been fantastic. So I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled as we enter into our spring, go into summer, because I think that there's going to be this renewed vigor coming for me for our shows, because I hate winter with a passion. So I'm real excited.
That's great to hear, because here on episode 29, I am one day removed from my air conditioning breaking down in South Florida, and I don't care what time of year it is, that's a problem. On this show, we're not going to just break kayfabe on the wrestling business, we'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. Barry, we're going to break kayfabe on life, except for today. Today is a special edition. Today, we are finally going to delve into unsolved murders and mysteries. I know you're excited about that, Barry, but before we do, even though this is going to be a, let's say 98% not about wrestling, we need to acknowledge a couple of recent passings. Boy, Barry, it's been a rough week for people in the news dying.
This has been it removed the wrestling aspect of it. They say that this happens in threes. I think this happened in sixes or nines, in multiples of threes. Because it really has. And, you know, we're recording this and Vern Troyer has just passed away recently. But, you know, the names over the last week of Harry Anderson and Barbara Bush and then the wrestling connection, which I know for me was kind of this knee to the groin. And I know that you felt the same way.
Yeah. And folks, just to let you know, we're going to discuss briefly here before we get into our unsolved, nothing like going from the death of Bruno Sammartino and Johnny V into unsolved mysteries. But we're going to discuss those two next week. We're going to delve more into the life and career of number one, Paul Jones, because Barry, I know that you had a relationship with Paul over the years. You actually spent a great deal of time talking to Paul about his careers. Let's give the folks a little preview of what we're going to be talking about next week.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So losing Paul was a big deal to me, and I'll give you a little bit of the history, and then I'll tell you one quick Paul Jones story to whet your appetite. But I did post the interview that I did with Paul, and I posted it on the Breaking Kayfabe with Vowdern and Barry Facebook group page. If you're listening and you're not a member, please join the group. But I did an interview with Paul, and I want to say it was done in 2003. And I was so taken with Paul after this interview, because there is no filter. There was no filter, I should say. Paul was not playing any sort of political game. He put his middle finger up, and basically it was a fuck you to everybody that had ever burned him in the business, and he didn't care. And I really enjoyed my conversation with him. And about a week or two after the interview, and I put it on my old CWF Archives website, the response was so good that I reached out and I was like, Paul, would you be interested in telling your life story and doing, you know, your autobiography? I would love to work with you on it. He said yes. And then in turn, we spent about 2 to 3 months speaking 5 times a week for an hour or 2 hours each time, going over his life and his career. And he was a fascinating guy. The book got derailed, and I'll definitely go into it more next week. But if you haven't seen the interview, you definitely want to see it, because, again, it really is who Paul was. He did not give a shit, and he would tell you exactly what he thought. But one of the things he always talked about was his relationship with Johnny Valentine. And Johnny Valentine was a guy that Paul had the ultimate respect for. And he said, you know, of the hundreds of times that I worked with Johnny Valentine, which really Florida, the Mid-Atlantic, I believe even in Texas a few times, they wrestled each other. He would always say that, you know, and Paul was an amateur boxer. I believe he was a Golden Gloves boxer, if I remember correctly. And he would say, Valentine would say, lay these in. You know, don't hold anything back, just slug the shit out of me. And Paul said he had all the respect for Johnny Valentine as a human being and as a wrestler, but at the same time, Johnny's ribs would actually cross the line. And he told me a couple, and I want to make it brief, obviously, and save a lot for next week. But Paul said Johnny had this habit that whenever he would go to a hotel, he would go to the ice machine. He would first drink a gallon of beer, a gallon of water, to the point that his bladder, he couldn't hold it. Then he would go and take a 5-minute piss in an ice machine. He would then wait for it to freeze, and he would come back, and he would wait to see people scooping out the ice and bringing it to their rooms. And he said he took a perverse pleasure in doing that. He said the other thing that he did was when Johnny Valentine would check out of a hotel room prior to leaving, he would take a big shit and then smear it all over the bed, the sheets, and the walls. And I asked Paul, and I'm like, so what would be the purpose? And he goes, I don't know. He just enjoyed doing it. So Johnny was a really interesting guy. But Paul was a guy that had so many stories. He had a really fantastic career. The modern generation knows him from his days as a manager, which really, we can honestly say he wasn't a great manager, at least in my opinion. He didn't connect with me at all. I found he was comical and a little bit hokey. But as a wrestler, Paul Jones in the early 70s was as good as anybody. He was a main event heel in the state of Florida, then became a main event babyface, and had a run of about 2 years. And if Eddie Graham, especially during that period of Jack Briscoe, of Buddy Cold, of every top name, Bill Watts, Dusty Rhodes, you know, if Eddie Graham was putting you on top with those guys, you were fucking great. So Paul Jones was really one of the unheralded talents. Didn't make it, you know, didn't really in the 90s, it was over. He was out of the mainstream and you know, with the expansion of the WWE and then the NWA, WCW into the 90s, he wasn't a part of that, and it's a real shame. But I have hours of stories, and obviously, as you said, this week we are wrapped up with everything that we're doing, but I'll be excited to talk about it next week.
Two things real quick before we move along here. I want you next week to tell the story about when Paul Jones first was introduced to Eddie Graham by the Briscoes, because that's a pretty funny rib that's not mean-spirited. And the second thing is that people need to know about Paul Jones is, you know, for all the bragging Ric Flair does about being a, you know, the man that had, you know, Space Mountain, let me tell you something. Wrestling legend has it that nobody got as many women as Paul Jones did. That guy was scoring some women back in the day.
Yeah, that guy was scoring women. And also another thing, there's just so much about Paul's life, and we'll talk about the book and what actually exists right now from the book. But he and Dick Slater were at one time brothers-in-law, and it was just prior to Paul getting married. But you're 100% right. Paul got more women than anybody else that I'm aware of in professional wrestling, with the exception of Ric Flair. Now, something came out this past week that Paul had slept with Jane Mansfield. And I got to be honest, I did, 100, 200 hours of talking with Paul, and he never mentioned that he had banged Jane Mansfield. However, and I'm not going to reveal it this week, so this will be a cliffhanger. You will have to tune into the next week's episode. Paul claimed to have taken the virginity of somebody, a real famous female singer who is no longer with us. And I'll leave it at that.
And I know and who you're talking about.
You do. I think you do. And I will leave it at that. But I will also say, of all the bragging that people do, I believe Paul in this case. And there's a reason why. And we'll discuss it next week.
Yeah. And by the way, if you don't know the answer to the person that Barry is discussing, by buying my book, Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Wrestling Legends, you will find out, because it's mentioned in that book. But I digress. So, Barry, before we go full on, give me some details. I know, you know, Lord knows we've lost Bruno Sammartino, who they called the living legend, and he certainly deserved that honor. Also, Johnny Valiant, Tom Sullivan, I believe, was his shoot name. Just killed tragically in a hit by a car, I think, crossing the highway. Both these guys had some time in Florida. You're the resident CWF expert. Give us some details very quickly about when these guys appeared in Florida and how it went for them.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I should also say I was in Pittsburgh about 3.5 weeks ago, and both these guys were still alive. And fuck, I visit Pittsburgh, and it was funny. My son says to me, he goes, what if we see Kurt Angle walking down the street? And then I'm like, fuck, what if we see Bruno Sammartino walking down the street? So it was a big deal. So Bruno only made two appearances in Florida that I'm ever aware of. One was on Christmas Day, 1964, Miami Beach. He wrestled and defeated Duke Kiyomoka. Came back in 1975, January of 75, and he wrestled on a big card in St. Petersburg, and he defeated Professor Toru Tanaka. And there's a real famous photo out there that somebody took that night. I think it was Jerry Prater who did the programs for weeks, and it's NWA World's Heavyweight Champion Jack Briscoe sitting next to Bruno Sammartino, who was the WWF champion, and they're sitting on a bench talking to each other, and they're smiling. It literally, it's just an iconic photo when you see it, but Bruno never had a big career in CWF for whatever the reason was, but the two appearances kind of coincide, and this is something that I think we've discussed previously, is that a lot of guys from the Northeast or the Midwest would somehow make a shot or shots in Florida during the winter months. And a lot of that was a tax write-off. So guys like Nick Bockwinkel, Larry the Axe Hennig, Bruno, Mad Dog Vachon, a lot of these guys would come down when the weather sucked in other places. They'd work a match, maybe five matches, but they'd be able to write all this off. And I don't think it was the payoff that they were really interested in. It was that I could turn this into a working vacation. So they didn't have a huge career. Johnny Valiant, though, so we saw Johnny Valiant in the 1960s as John L. Sullivan, only around for a couple of months at best, didn't get a push, new to the business. And then the Valiant brothers showed up in 1978, and they wrestled that big card at the Super Bowl of Wrestling against Mike Graham and Steve Kern. And then for the next 6 months, they would only come in and do a couple of shots. They might be in Orlando or Tampa, Miami, Jacksonville. But we would see them every so often. And then the Valiant brothers broke up, and Johnny Valiant came in as a single in 1980. And he came in, he was going to get this huge push. And it was always evident in the state of Florida, they would put you on the front cover of the program, and it would say something like, I'm here to win the title. And then invariably, that person would win the title a week or two later, always foreshadowing exactly what was going to happen. And in Johnny Valiant's case, he came in, and he was a guy that did not work a Florida style. You know, and Jimmy Valiant certainly didn't work a Florida style either. And Eddie Graham was more about either amateur, if you were a real wrestler, or if you look stiff in the ring. And Johnny Valiant was really neither of those things. It didn't, at least it didn't show in his matches. So his push ended extremely quick. He stuck around for maybe 2 months, and I think towards the end of his run here, he was doing jobs to Bubba Douglas. So it really never went anywhere. He never went too far with this. And years ago, I asked a friend of his, I was like, you know, so whatever happened with Johnny? He was supposed to come in and make a big deal in Florida, and then he was gone and nothing happened. And they said, well, he wanted to come back to his home in the Northeast. And you know, I don't know how much truth there really was to that, because I know that after he left Florida, he wound up going to the Mobile area, the Gulf Coast region, and he wrestled there for a few months. So I just think he just didn't fit in the state of Florida. It just wasn't the same kind of style. But, you know, real sad to hear. And losing Bruno, you know, I met Bruno once, as I think you did, which was 2005, and at the Wrestle Reunion show in Tampa. And he was such a nice guy. And he was a guy, I'm going to say he was 5'9", maybe 5'10". He wasn't a tall guy. He was older. He was bald at that point. And when Bruno came in, it was like the Pope had just walked. I'll never forget it. It was like the Pope had just walked in. And this was an event where you had Dusty Rhodes, you had Bill Watts, Barry Windham, you had guys like Kevin Nash and Roddy Piper. Yet when Bruno showed up, who really had no connection to the state of Florida, there was such a buzz, and he was such a happy guy. He was smiling, he was joking, and people were so excited to see him. And you know, I said something this past week, and I put it online in one of the forums on Facebook. And it's a cliche. It's a cliche as old as time, which is a whole nother cliche. And this is an end of an era. And truly, with Bruno's passing, it almost is like that's an end of an era right there. So I was real saddened to hear of all the deaths that occurred in professional wrestling. And it really was a need of the groin for me. How about you?
Yeah, Bruno, I just posted on today on the Facebook group, the very first wrestling magazine I can remember buying was when I was a kid in Key West, Florida. We lived there, and there was a, boy, see if you remember this, Barry, Neisner's department store, which is kind of like a Woolworths, but they sold wrestling magazines, and I picked up an Inside Wrestling. I posted the image of the cover. It was a real nice shot of Bruno with the WWF title. On it. I think it was from October of 1971, somewhere in that general area. And it's a really good pose shot of Bruno in the belt. And, you know, I grew to appreciate Bruno, had never seen him because, you know, like you said, he didn't come down to Florida. We were seeing, you know, Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk, Buddy Colt, those guys. And, you know, I only watched Bruno's career through the wrestling magazines, through the After magazines and, you know, The Ring and Wrestling Review, that kind of thing. And I could remember when I was like, I would have been 12 years old in 1973, Inside Wrestling had another cover shot of Bruno with the belt, confetti in his hair, where he had regained the title from Stan Stasiak. And I remember as a 12-year-old kid going, yeah, because, of course, we hadn't heard anything. But I was like, yeah, Bruno's got the belt back. And I remember having a real visceral reaction as a 12-year-old. So and not only that, let me say one thing about Bruno that people probably don't appreciate enough is Bruno, if you listen to J.J. Dillon and other guys in the wrestling business, Bruno really would step forward for other guys in the wrestling business. Zbyszko, Johnny V, he got these guys started in the business. And he was always there with advice or to help them. You know, JJ tells a story about how he had gotten kind of shortened on a payoff as a referee. He mentioned it to Bruno. Bruno says, I'm glad you didn't go to the promoter and mention it. Let me do that. That's my place to do that. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, you know, I just can't see the Hulkster doing that for people. Maybe he did it for his, you know, people that were friends of his. But here was a guy that Bruno really didn't know at the time. JJ was, you know, a guy that he probably saw in the back, but it wasn't like a friend of his. And Bruno really, you know, went to bat for him and really stuck with JJ. And I thought that was an especially good point. Okay, listen, before we get too long into it, Barry, it is time. What is it Bruce Buffer says? It is time. It's time for us to talk about our top five unsolved mysteries or murder. Ooh, we're going away from the norm here, folks. I got to tell you, this is either going to be a really good show or it's going to be a complete crap fest. I have no idea. I don't think it's going to be anywhere in between, Barry. I don't know about you. But so let me just give you the genesis of the idea. First of all, I got to give credit my friends Kyle and Jeremy over at the Obtuse Angles podcast, which is a podcast. I turned Barry onto it. And Barry, I know you had a lot of fun watching it or listening to it. I'm sorry. Where they talked about, in one of their episodes some months ago, about these unsolved crimes and mysteries. And, you know, one of the things, Barry, that I love to do, I love to go on YouTube on the weekends, especially if, like today, there's a rainy day out and you really don't want to go outside. And you go to YouTube and you type in unsolved murders or unsolved mysteries. And, boy, you talk about going down the proverbial rabbit hole. And you can literally sit there and watch some of the stuff. And some of the stuff is just downright creepy. Some of it is like, whoa. And so what Barry and I did was we decided we're going to talk about there are both murders and there are just mysterious disappearances that we want to talk about. And the place where we start is at the beginning. To me, the number one unsolved murder of all time, and I'm nothing if not current, Barry, is going back to the 1880s, Jack the Ripper in Whitechapel. We are topical here on this show, Barry. And what happened was I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, there was a Johnny Depp movie called From Hell, which was based on a graphic novel. And I saw it, and I had seen that there was also, I believe, I don't know, Barry, if you saw it, there was a Michael Caine movie on Jack the Ripper that came out in 1988 that was also very good. And, you know, it just gives a version or a theory of the events of what happened with Jack the Ripper, just to give, you know, for those of you out there, the three of you listening that have never heard of Jack the Ripper, let me just give a brief summary on what Jack the Ripper was all about. 1988, from the summer to the autumn, in the Whitechapel district of London, which is a very low class end of London, five prostitutes who were between the ages of 30 and 40 were killed. They were killed very graphically. They had their throats slit. In some cases, they were, you know, disemboweled. They have kidneys, organs removed. You know, this was done specifically on weekends or on bank holidays. So it was believed by some that this was a local guy because he knew the schedule of the police. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of letters that were sent in to the police and the newspapers. Of all those letters that were sent in, two of them specifically were identified as probably being from the man who had committed the murder. And the name Jack the Ripper came from a letter that was sent where it was addressed Dear Boss and signed Jack the Ripper. In the movie From Hell, there was a scene where the guy had mailed, I believe, to a newspaper half a kidney. And he indicated that he had eaten the other kidney, and a little Silence of the Lambs were out there. So there was some suspicion that maybe this man had some medical skill, or he'd been an educated man where he'd operated almost with surgical precision on the victims. So the book Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution, which was published in 1979 by Stephen Knight, points to a doctor, Dr. William Gull. Now, in the movie From Hell, Dr. William Gull is portrayed by, oh my God, Barry, I'm trying to think now. It's the guy from the Lord of the Rings movie. So he plays that. And one of the things that they kind of disputed is because in real life, the doctor would have been in his 70s. He had just recovered from a stroke. So, you know, there's some suspicion thrown on that particular theory. But this is one of these cases where there are so many different angles and suppositions as to who it might have been. Barry, I know you've had a chance very briefly just to look on some of this and tell me some of your thoughts on this mystery.
Yeah, so first off, that movie From Hell I was never a fan of, and I've always found Johnny Depp really just overblown as an actor. But hey, enough of that. So I did. So the first thing is, if you go and you get online and you get onto Google and you punch in Jack the Ripper, there's probably 200 things that come up. And the first 200 or the first 100 of those 200 are the top Jack the Ripper suspects. And there are. So Dr. Gull, as you just mentioned, seemed to be the prime suspect. But as people try to sell books, and this is kind of a recurring theme, as people try to sell books or to try to get something sold, whether it's a TV show, a book, a movie, etc., it's almost like new suspects are being identified. And even though we're removed now by 100 and something years, people are coming up with these new theories, and it's, you know, at this point, we're never going to know exactly who Jack the Ripper was. Arguably, maybe the most famous serial killer of all time. Is that even arguable, Jeff?
You know, it's. I think he kind of established the genre, if you will, as crazy as that sounds, because he was the first famous killer of multiple people. I think one of the really interesting suppositions, there's also a gentleman named Francis Tumblety, who is he was a doctor that was kind of thought of as a quack. He had been accused and convicted of certain criminal acts. So he was one of the suspects. My most interesting possibility is a guy named H.H. Holmes. And there was recently a show, I want to say it was either on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel. H.H. Holmes was a guy who may have been this country's first serial killer. And H.H. Holmes was working at his craft, the serial killing, in Chicago right around the turn of the century, when the World's Fair was there. There was a book that came out a few years ago called Devil in the White City, and it basically told the story of H.H. Holmes and how he built this house in Chicago, and he built this house with all these secret rooms, these trap doors that led to, like almost dungeons, and he tortured and killed people just in totally extreme and graphic nature. I won't even get into some of the just sick stuff that this guy did. But the reason I bring this guy up is because there is a timeline that shows that H.H. Holmes was actually in London during 1888. So people suspect that H.H. Holmes may have traveled to London, committed these crimes, and then gone back to the United States, which is why the police in London never were able to capture the guy that was Jack the Ripper.
Jeff, I think you may have just solved Jack. Are you selling a book, Jeff, about this? Are
you? Well, you know, I'm working on a book, but it's not about Jack the Ripper. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, there you go. All right.
Okay, so now let's go to our number four in our top five as we're counting backwards here. Barry, this is one that hits a little home for you and I because it occurred here in South Florida. I believe both of us, you were living here in 1980? Or 81?
Absolutely yeah. Was.
And yeah. That is the murder of Adam Walsh. And, you know, I know a lot of you now are saying, oh, wait a minute, the murder of Adam Walsh, they know who did that. Well, we're going to throw a little bit of speculation on that, because Adam Walsh, for those of you who don't know, because I know we have some listeners that are outside the continental United States, Adam Walsh was a young boy who was 6 years old. He was abducted on July 27th, 1981. He was in Hollywood, Florida, which is it's located between Miami and Fort Lauderdale here in South Florida. He was at the mall with his mother, and his mother had gone off to do a little bit of shopping within the Sears store. And Adam was playing with some other boys. They were playing a video game, and his mom said, "Okay, I'm going to be over there looking at outfits," or something like that. And Adam says, "Okay." Well, apparently what happens, Barry, is there's some kind of ruckus at the video game, and one of the security guys comes over and tells the kids, "Okay, you kids, you're going to be doing this. You're going to be fooling around. You need to leave the store." And he told them to go to the exit store that was closest to where they were. And Adam was shown out of the store along with the other boys. And what happened was, it was an exit that was not the exit that Adam and his mom usually left by, where their car was. And so Adam was in a very, you know, to him, a strange location, a six-year-old boy. And his mom at some point starts looking for him. Okay. So there comes a period of time where, let's see here, about 90 minutes goes by.
It's even a little bit weirder than that.
Okay.
So as Adam is shown the door, so the group of boys, I guess they started arguing in front of this Atari set. They were playing the Atari. She had put him there to keep him occupied. When the security guard shows them, and you're right, they went out a different exit. The other boys were all friends, so they all left together. This left six-year-old Adam Walsh standing outside of a mall at a strange exit by himself. And he was too shy to say anything to the security guard. The mother apparently runs into the grandmother. I don't think it was her mother. I think it was John
Correct.
Walsh's mother, who
Correct.
Happens to be in Sears. However, there was some sort of dispute with this. Apparently, one of the allegations made at the time, and I don't know if this was ever backed up or ever justified, was that she was having an affair on John Walsh, the wife, who I think was named Reeve. So she was having an affair on John Walsh, and apparently this wasn't the first time that she had taken Adam and set him in front of this Atari machine to keep him occupied while she went off with her boyfriend. Coincidentally, they also divorced. The Walshes divorced not too long after Adam died, if I'm correct. But I always thought that was odd that she would be in the mall, and I believe this mall is since demolished, if I'm correct. But that she would be in the mall, and she would actually run into John Walsh's mother as she was looking for Adam. But you're right about the 90-minute timeline as well.
Yeah, so 90 minutes elapses. They're frantically searching for Adam. They can't find him. After 90 minutes, they call the police. The police come in. They're looking. The kid has disappeared. Okay, now, the way people believe things happened, there's a gentleman whose name is Otis Toole, okay? Otis Toole in 1996 died of liver failure. He's a guy that we've actually mentioned on Breaking Kayfabe before, because I believe Barry discussed the movie Henry: Portrait of a Serial Killer, which was about Otis Toole's good friend, Henry Lucas. So Otis Toole confessed before he died in September of 96 of liver failure to the killing of Adam Walsh. Okay. Now stay with me here, folks. So apparently, according to what Otis Toole said, he drove north on the turnpike about 130 miles, which would put him, I want to say, like Port St. Lucie or just a bit north of there. And he wanted to take Adam home with him to be his son or something like that. Adam, is even at 6 years old, is beginning to freak out and starts becoming rather frantic. Otis Toole told his niece that he punched Adam to keep him quiet, and then got the car off the main road, strangled him, I believe, with a some sort of cord. I know he was asphyxiated, though. And then he decapitated Adam after he died. Okay. The head of Adam Walsh is eventually located. And I'll tell you, Barry, a really scary thing that I remember from being 20 years old at the time. I had gone on vacation with my mom. We had flown all the way from Florida up to Alaska. And the reason I remember this incident specifically is we flew up the day that the air traffic controllers went on strike, there was a big dispute with President Reagan, and they all went on strike. We flew out the day they went on strike. That was a real comfortable feeling, flying out on a major airliner as the guys were on strike. So we flew back in from Alaska, and we got home, and you know, my dad had kind of let the papers pile up and stuff like that. So we picked up the day's paper, and we spread it out on the kitchen table, and the headline in the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel was "Adam's Head Found." And boy, you talk about, whoa, that's something that's always stuck with me, how shocking that headline was. Just crazy scenario, Barry.
Yeah, so this whole case for me was kind of a turning point in my life, and I kind of referred to it as the loss of innocence in my life. And where I had grown up in a very idyllic situation in a 20th floor condominium facing the beach, and everything was clean and pristine, and I was kind of sheltered from the harsh realities of life. And I had been in this relationship, which was kind of my first serious relationship with this girl, and we had broken up, and I was kind of devastated by it. I had never, you know, I guess my heart was snapped in two, and I had never been hurt before. And I was dating a new girl, and we were riding bikes. I'll never forget this. We were riding bikes in the North Miami section, and we went back to her house, and we turned on the TV, and they were discussing the case about just discovering the head. And it really hit me. Like, it was almost like if somebody had just taken a hammer to my head, because it had such an impact. And I sat there, and I was like, you know, there's a six-year-old boy, and somebody would fucking cut his head off. And I guess I had never paid attention to serial killers or whatever it was before. So this really was my foray into it. And I was so, I guess, injured in a sense that somebody could do this to a poor child. And then you see John and Reavy on television, and they're crying, they're hysterical. And, you know, as a parent, Jeff, you're a parent, we understand it much better now, but, you know, the horrors of something like that. So it really did hit home. And obviously, being in South Florida, there was a real, real connection to it. So, you know, the whole thing with Toole and Henry Lee Lucas, did they do it? And I know that the sheriff, I believe he was the Broward County sheriff at the time, actually closed the case and said that there's enough evidence, even though Toole was never convicted of this, that there was enough evidence that the case should be closed. We're satisfied that he's the killer. From what I've read, I don't know if I'm totally satisfied that he is.
Well, I'll tell you, what's interesting is not only was he never convicted, Otis Toole was never even charged with the offense.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And the reason was because there was just a horrific bungling of this case by the Hollywood Police Department. And there was a Cadillac that was recovered from Otis Toole that allegedly had a carpet that had some blood on it. Okay. And of course, that would be a major, major piece of physical evidence in any case proceeding against Otis Toole if they wanted to try him. They somehow managed to lose the carpet from inside the Cadillac. And needless to say, that put a little damper on their case there.
They've also lost the car, though. If I'm correct, I remember reading, they lost the fucking car.
Yeah. So what makes it even crazier, though, as you said, you know, you're not really sure if it was Otis Toole. First of all, Otis Toole and Henry Lee Lucas were known to give false confessions. That's a consistent pattern between the two of them, you know, to get themselves publicity or, you know, some sort of sick fame. I don't really know. But here's what really makes it extra creepy was that in 2007, their allegations came out that in the state of Florida at this time, in the South Florida area in 1981 in the summer, there was a guy whose name you may have heard of him, Barry. His name was Jeffrey Dahmer. That's a little bit creepy, huh? So now this brings – and reportedly, when he was in prison before he was killed by another prisoner, Jeffrey Dahmer was even approached and asked. And he claimed that he did not have anything to do with it. But that just makes an extra creepy factor to this whole thing. Let's see. There were two eyewitnesses that reportedly had placed Jeffrey Dahmer at the mall. And severing heads – was part of Jeffrey Dahmer's, dare I say, Barry, modus operandi. So, you know, it makes the whole thing creepier. So now in 2008, in December, December 16th, the Hollywood PD officially listed the case as being closed. They feel satisfied that Otis Toole was, in fact, the killer. I want to give one other little tail end of this story here. So I'm talking with my wife one night at dinner, and I mentioned, you know, we're going to do this episode. And she says, oh, well, which case are you going to talk about? So I mentioned the Adam Walsh case. And I said, you know, most people seem to believe that Otis Toole was the killer in this circumstance. But, you know, there's some questions, you know, as Barry, you know, as you mentioned, there's some questions that make you think, I'm not 100% sure on this, you know, kind of what ifs. And then my wife says, well, you know our connection to this case, don't you? And I looked at her and said, no. My wife then proceeds to tell me that a very good friend of ours, a woman, I won't use her real name because she has asked us not to, but I will say that in the book that John Walsh wrote about, you know, losing his son and all the events that went on, John Walsh mentioned this particular woman. I don't know if she mentioned her by name or not, but mentioned her in the story. At the time, about 3 days before Adam was kidnapped, this woman that my wife and I know, who Barry, came to our wedding with her husband, told the story about how she was approached by Otis Toole in a Kmart in Hollywood, Florida. She says that her mom was out shopping. She was a couple feet away from her in the aisleway. Otis Toole came by. She apparently would have been about, I want to say 9 or 10 years old at the time. He got a shopping cart. He's pushing it. He says, hey, would you like to go for a ride in the shopping cart? I'll push you around the store. And our friend said, excuse me? And he said, yeah, come on, get in. I'll push you around the store. At that point, her mom walks by and says, can I help you? He says, oh, no, nothing. I was just leaving. And he smiled. And if you remember any picture you see of Otis Toole, he has that very famous gap tooth smile. You know what I'm talking about, Barry?
Yeah. And he was missing teeth, I think, as well.
And absolutely. She specifically remembered that smile because after what happened, they went. You know, when Otis Toole became a suspect, they went to the Hollywood PD and said, yeah, this guy approached me in the Hollywood Kmart, which was right down the street from the mall where Adam was abducted. So, boom. How creepy is that, Barry?
That's unbelievable. So when you told me this story, you told me this story months ago, I actually, and you did, you shared her name. I actually did some research, and this story made it in the newspapers. Like, this is verified in the newspapers that this actually happened. So it really is, and it's really, you know, when you get back to the bungling of the police and the fact that not only the carpet, but the fucking car is gone, and there was something else that they had also, and I forget what it was. There were three pieces of key evidence, and a Google search will actually show you what this is, but, I mean, that's just, it's unconscionable that could actually happen. So, I'm not convinced. Yeah, it does look like Toole is the guilty guy. Is it a coincidence that Jeffrey Dahmer was there? It probably is, because Jeffrey Dahmer strikes me, from what we know, as a guy who would have taken credit for this.
Yes,
but at
absolutely.
The same time, yeah, exactly. But it really is sad, and this was the genesis of John Walsh as far as the rest of his life going, you know, going forward with America's Most Wanted and being a successful author, written multiple books. You know, he started the Adam Walsh Foundation based off of this. So this was such a tragic story. And I got to say, my assumption on why did it hit home for me, it had to be the South Florida connection. I mean, you know, there's just nothing else I could think, because I don't think I was ever disturbed by any sort of serial killer or murder ever before, or probably even ever since, as what occurred with Adam Walsh. It was just devastating.
Yeah, it's so local in a lot of ways. It's the fact that, you know, the Stoneman Douglas shooting that occurred in February of this year, it happened literally a couple blocks away from where I live. Boy, you talk about bringing it home, you know, and just making things, you know, become so much more personalized. And, you know, Adam Walsh, for the people in South Florida, this was literally the lead story for, God, 6 months in the papers. And, you know, it started every time you go into, a restaurant, you go into a stop along a turnpike or a highway, and you see the list of all these missing children. And everybody knows what I'm talking about. Folks, that started with the disappearance of Adam Walsh. And you talk about a kind of a game changer. And, you know, his father, I've seen his father interviewed, and his father's talked, you know, you talk about a guy that wishes he wasn't in the position he was, you know, is in. because he was put in that position. He was thrust into that spotlight, and he became the guy behind America's Most Wanted because he had his child murdered just savagely. You know, they never found the rest of Adam's body, for God's sakes. They found his head, and they found it in a drainage ditch, and the rest of his body was just gone. I can't even imagine what that must be like as a parent having to live through that. So speaking of other horrifying things, this is kind of a downbeat show, Barry. I got to tell you.
We got to bring this up somehow.
I don't know.
We can do that.
I don't know how we're going to be able to do it, but
yeah.
But our number three, unsolved murders. Folks, I mentioned going on YouTube and discussing you know, how you go into unsolved murders and you get down this rabbit hole of finding these cases that just completely, you know, horrify you. But at the same time, you know, you're like, what is going on here? Let's talk about Barry. Number three is the Highway of Tears. The Highway of Tears is Highway 16 in British Columbia. It's a part of the East-West Corridor. It connects out of, I believe it's Prince Albert, I want to say, in the British Columbia. And it's a road that goes, and it's an incredibly desolate highway, and there's no public transportation. I think there's one bus that goes once a day. And anyway, the reason I bring this up is between the years 1969 and 2011, police say there have been 19 young women murdered. Now, it's interesting I say that police say, because the Native American community up there claims that the number may be 40 or higher. Women that have been murdered and killed along this highway. Okay. 13 of the 19 women, teenagers, 10 of them were Native American women. Now, there's some belief amongst the Native American community up there that the, you know, the police in charge up there is the RCMPs, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And there is belief that maybe they did a little bit of foot dragging on the old investigation, because after all, this was just, you know, they were just Indians, Barry. You know, they're not, you know, you're white Canadians, and that's the belief that some feel there. Now,
well, when you say that's the belief, I mean, the facts are clear that they did fucking drag their feet or just didn't move at all. I mean, the facts are so widespread with the corruption and the fact that they basically that these were considered. So these are considered Aboriginal. And I had to go and I had to say, because I always thought of Aborigines as coming from Australia, but apparently there's more to Aboriginal. So Aboriginal, they are, we would call them Native Americans, but they're essentially Indians that live in Canada. And it's, they did absolutely nothing, to the point of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced about a year and a half ago that he's doing a national inquiry into these murders and disappearances. So, you know, when you say that the cops may have been dragging their feet, this was a case where they were like, yeah, these are Native Americans. There's not a lot of record about this, you know, between the reservations and all that. This is not going to be any sort of priority for us. And in return, you mentioned that there's 19 murders. There may be 40. Do you know that in a New York Times article that appeared in 2016, as many as 4,000 indigenous women may have been murdered or disappeared?
Yeah, the number is 4,200. That's the belief of the what they call the First Nation up there. That's what the Indians refer to themselves up there.
Insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you know, one of the things that really stuck with me was I watched one of the YouTube clips on it, and they were interviewing one of the Native American women, an older member of the community, who said, "Yeah, you think about it. If that number is anywhere close to that, we're talking about a generation or two of Native Americans that have been lost, you know, that these women who were not able to have the next generation of children. And, you know, that's like an entire generation that conceivably is wiped out because of these deaths. Now, let's talk about some of the beliefs as to what happened. As I said, this is an incredibly lonely, desolate part of town, road that goes from one town to the next. It's, you know, like truckers, loggers. But like literally when you leave town, Barry, they said you're more likely – one of the things really said, you're more likely to see a bear on the road than see a human being. That's how desolate the stretch of highway is. So what happens is, because there's no public transportation, if you got a woman that's going from like just say from one part of town out to her home, if she doesn't have a car, she's got to hitchhike. That's the only way you're going to get without just walking this lonely stretch of road where it's probably black as pitch, because there ain't no streetlights out there, folks. You're in the middle of the woods, the forest. You're in the middle of the Canadian Rockies, I guess you could say. So you're talking about a real lonely stretch of road. And, you know, when you get picked up by a trucker, the trucker could conceivably just pull off the road and go into off a dirt road. And there is no one that's going to know you're there. And it is pretty scary, particularly when you think about a guy named Bobby Jack Fowler, who was known to work those roads as a driver, and he was known to be in British Columbia during the time period of these deaths, and he was known to be a serial rapist. He died in prison in 2006 in Oregon after being convicted of rape in Oregon. This was not a nice guy. And that these people, what this guy Fowler has been suspected of doing was he would move from area to area before the police had a chance to catch up with them. And this guy would work, you're talking about a very desolate section of land. So, and people are moving in and out of there because of the trucking industry. So this guy's able to slip in and out of there and nobody notices the guy. It's just absolutely crazy. Plus, you talked about, there is a story that's also on there that involves a man in the government named George, I believe it's pronounced Gratis. And George Gratis, well, was one of the people that was accused of sort of dragging their feet by the Native American community. George Gratis reportedly engaged in what was called triple deletion of files. In other words, he didn't just delete certain files regarding the suspects and the cases. He triple deleted them. He would delete them, then he'd go into the body of his computer, delete them off there, and then delete them one more time to make sure, by God, no one found these documents and these facts. And there are boxes upon boxes. Remember that famous scene in Indiana Jones at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you go into that warehouse where there's just all these boxes and boxes of artifacts that the government is stashing? That's kind of like what you see when you go into these file rooms for this one particular case that's called the Highway of Tears case. Another suspect was a guy named Gary Taylor Handlin, was a guy that was suspected. There was another guy named Cody I'm going to mispronounce this one, Legabakov, who
I know the name, though. Yes.
Yeah. He was actually convicted of murdering 3 to 4 women. So now what makes this crazy is we might be looking at multiple killers. This was like basically, you've heard of the famous movie we talked about recently, The Killing Fields. What a great – that this area is almost like a killing fields. This is like ground zero for serial killers, because there's – obviously, you go after Native American women, the police aren't really interested because they're Native Americans. They're aboriginals. And it's just completely horrifying. This has been going on, over a period of over 30, almost 40 years this went on. And it's just crazy to think, the number is either 19, 40, or 4,200. I mean, that's just absolutely insane, Barry.
4,200. And again, because there wasn't a lot of records kept on these women. Some of these women, this is unlike, there was that case in Long Island, New Jersey, where the prostitutes were being killed and dumped. And this wasn't a case of girls that were prostitutes or girls that were drug abusers, though there may have been some mixed in that. This was a case of 16-year-old girls wanting to get from point A to point B, and they're hitchhiking, and they're being picked up, and they're killed. But the fact that mothers, daughters, sisters, thousands of these women have either been murdered or disappeared, and you've got some fucking asshole doing triple deletion on files? I mean, this is a new level of corruption, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's just absolute insanity. And I'll tell you, folks, we mentioned first Jack the Ripper, how you go into YouTube and you or Google and you hit Jack the Ripper and all these cases come up, and you look into Adam Walsh, and certainly myriad of cases are going to come up. Go on to YouTube or Google and type in Highway of Tears and just read some of the completely horrifying aspects of these cases of they have interviews with parents, much like John and Reeve Walsh, parents whose child may have gone out to a party and just never returned. And, there's people that there's a one particular story that's out there on YouTube where some friends had gone out camping one night, and there were like, 4 or 6 of them or something like that. And they were, partying and stuff like that. I don't know if they were drinking, but who cares? But they're out there. And at some point, I don't know if it was the weather or what, but a some of the group decide they're just going to head back into town. And the tent was up. So one girl decides, I'm going to just stay here and spend the night here. And they come back to find her, and she's gone. And literally, there's been no trace of this woman since then. And the scary thing is that one of the girls talks about how she has been shunned by her friends because the girl, that was her ride. And she left the girl there because the girl said, I want to spend the night here. And so her friend left, went back to town, came back, couldn't find the friend. So now our friends are throwing the, you got her killed angle at her because she chose to go back town. And, you know, it just, it split families. It split communities. People are looking at one another, wondering if it's you. Plus you got the angle of the story that these truckers are coming in and out of this town and nobody knows who they are. And I really believe, Barry, you know, we mentioned Bobby Jack Fowler. We mentioned Gary Handlin. We mentioned this Cody Legabikoff. There are multiple killers working here. And I really think that this area almost fosters these people because it's so remote and just so out there.
That's a great point, too. And I would have to agree with you because, again, they've already proven that there's more than one individual who is responsible for this. So I think it is. And I think that if you get into an area, and again, we're looking at a desolate strip of highway that's, you know, over 400 miles long, that, you know, yeah, it has to be more than one person. And it's and it makes you wonder if these killers, you know, obviously they're mentally ill to some degree, they're gravitating towards areas like this. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, we don't often see this on busy stretches of road. They're going to be either in neighborhoods or pieces of land that are a little more remote and a little bit more desolate. So this is such a sad, sad story. When you see that billboard, I know you've seen the billboard, girls don't hitchhike, and it lists victims and their names and things. And you just go, my God, this is so sad. But the fact that, you know, that these mothers have lost their daughters and the government is, you know, was sitting around for years with their thumbs up their asses doing nothing about this. And finally, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau is the one who is stepping forward and is like, you know what, we're going to try to do something about this. And just unbelievable and really sad. And I got to say, this was not something that I was overly familiar with until you said you wanted to discuss this. And then I went on and I started doing the research and started looking at this, and it was like, oh my God. And there are some videos that are out there with the relatives of the people who have either missing or killed. And you just, you know, and it's real sad. We're looking, there's 16-year-old girls who have been killed. You know, there's the real famous case that's associated with this. And it's a 16-year-old girl that was just trying to get to the next town, and she was killed. And then there's multiple members of families that are either murdered or disappeared, and the government was doing nothing. We're talking multiple members, multiple young girls just missing. And everybody in that town, where I guess where it starts, everybody knows somebody who is either missing or dead. I mean, it's unfathomable when you think about it.
Yeah, and you sit and think as a parent, you know, Adam Walsh's parents, just to go back to that case briefly, you know, their son's head was recovered, for God's sakes. And as horrifying as that must be, imagine if that had never been recovered. And Adam just, and there are people out there who've had family members that just disappeared. And, you know, that whole not knowing, you know, that just the fact that you don't know what happened to your child. I can't even imagine that, you know, and I can't imagine, you know, they say that no parent should ever have to bury a child. These people couldn't bury their child because their child never came back. And they're sitting there thinking, oh, well, I really hope that my child comes back when, you know, they've been gone 20 years. There's probably a really good chance that they're not coming back, but that those people, it's so sad. Those people have to live with that, you know, they sit there and grasp to these straws that one day their child's going to walk through the door now as an adult 20 years later or whatever. And literally you can go on YouTube and you can see interviews with every single person, all those 19 quotation marks that the police say is the total. And, you know, as opposed to the 40 or the 4,200 or whatever it is, but it's just
4,200.
Yeah,
Jeff.
That's just crazy.
Fucking 200. And we're not talking, this is not some third world. We're not talking Uganda. This is not a third world country. We're talking Canada, which, you know, it's supposed to be more civilized than the U.S. Yeah. What?
Yeah, definitely.
Unbelievable.
you know, definitely somebody out there is dropping the ball on this, because this is just absolutely horrifying. Okay, now we're going to go from a murder to a I guess you could call this not a murder. Well, maybe it was more of a mysterious disappearance. And this is one, again, I got to give credit to Kyle and Jeremy for turning me on. And that is on the 19th of February in 2013. Folks, if you want to see, you know, you talk about disturbing, weird, and then there's the just plain freaky shit. Look up the name on Google of Alicia Lam. It's L-A-M-M. Alicia Lam was a Chinese woman from Vancouver who came down to Los Angeles in the early part of 2013. Now, let me give you a couple background details on Alicia. Alicia was a student. She was a very intelligent woman, but she was known to have some mental issues, possibly be bipolar. She was definitely on some medication. So Alyssa comes down and she checks into a hotel in Los Angeles called the Cecil Hotel. Let's just say the Cecil is not the Ritz, and it's in a very poor part of town. It's a very large hotel. But the residents are not the pillars of the community. Let's just say that.
It's a shitty flop house.
Exactly. That's kind of where it is. And you know, people say that they can't understand why of all the hotels, she decided to pick that one. That's one of the first mysteries. So here's what happens, just to, you know, to give you a very brief synopsis, and then we'll go into greater detail. So her parents try to call her and they can't get in touch with her. Okay. So they contact the police. The police come out. They bring the police dogs. They search her room. Nobody's seen hide nor hair of Alicia. They don't know what's happened to her. They then stumble upon a videotape from the hotel, the security monitors. And boy, if you want to be just see something that's just freaky weird, look at the 4-minute video on Alicia Lam. Barry, did you get a chance to watch that 4-minute video?
I did watch it. Yes. Yeah. I watched it twice because it is freaky. So yes. Yeah.
So what you see in the video is a woman who's in some sort of distress, whether it is physical distress because she's running from someone, or she's in some sort of emotional stress because she's having a manic episode. It's kind of hard to tell. So what happens is you see Alicia in this hotel or in this hotel elevator by herself, and she's standing very rigid at attention. Then she steps out in the hallway. You cannot see the camera does not pick up what is happening in the hallway. She appears to be gesturing to someone in the hallway. You're not entirely sure if that's what's going on, though, or if she's just having a manic episode. She then gets back in the elevator, but she does it almost with a military-like precision. Would that be fair to say, Barry?
Yeah.
And then she goes into the corner like she's, you know, putting her face in the corner like she's playing a game of hide and go seek, which has led some people to believe that she was playing a game of hide and go seek with somebody in the hotel. So then it gets weirder. She goes out into the hallway for a period of time. The elevator door remains open. I don't really know how. So then she jumps back into the elevator and she starts pushing all the buttons, you know, as if maybe she's trying to escape and she's just getting the door to close. So we don't really know what's going on. Okay. So now police investigate. Nobody knows what happens to Alicia. So then a couple weeks goes by, Barry. They can't find, you know, no clue. The parents apparently go back home. And we have another one of these mysteries about what happened to our daughter. Well, then suddenly the people that live in the hotel, because there are residents there, it's not, you know, a place where you're staying like you go to the Holiday Inn or something like that. These people are living there. They start complaining about the fact that there's a certain odor to the water. And a couple of the other tenants are complaining that the water appears to be a little discolored. Well, like I said, this is an older hotel. And on top of the hotel itself, there are 4 separate water towers. Okay. Now, to remind you, the access to the hotel is locked. Okay. You get on the roof, you have to go through a lock to get into the water tower. Every one of the water towers is locked. One of the hotel workers gets up onto the hotel roof, opens up the lock to the different water towers. When he gets to one of them, he finds Alicia floating in the water tank, dead. Her decomposing body is what's caused the water to discolor and have a weird odor. Yeah, that's got to make you real comfortable if you're a guest at the Cecil Hotel, Barry.
Yeah, well, and I hope to never be a guest at the Cecil Hotel. So we look at her. She was a young woman. She was 21 years old. There was a history of mental illness, whether she was bipolar. She was on 4 different types of medication. I don't know how they interact with each other. but she was an attractive woman too. When you see the still photographs of her, she was actually extremely pretty, I thought. The Cecil Hotel, and you've been extremely kind, Jeff, in your description of the Cecil. It was a shithole. It was a place where people would stay on a weekly or monthly basis. They were down on their luck. There were 16 deaths at the Cecil prior to the Alyssa Lam either murder or death. And all of those 16 deaths were either the result of a suicide, accident, or murder. So it was nothing that was natural causes. And there may have even been a 17th, as a lady was poisoned there, and there was just no record if she lived or died. Coincidentally or not, it was also in connection with a couple of well-known murders, one being the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short, who was murdered in 1947. And that's an amazing story, which I know you're real familiar with. But she actually was seen hanging out at the bar at the Cecil before she was murdered. It was also the residence of Richard Ramirez. So really one of the biggest and I guess most well-known serial killers of all time, Richard Ramirez, lived there in 1985. And then a guy, I believe he's Austrian, named Jack Unterweger, and I'm sure I'm fucking butchering that last name, was there in 1991 living there. And he was an Austrian serial killer who was murdering sex workers in several countries. So he was first convicted of a 74 murder, but then was deemed rehabilitated and released in 1990. Of course, you know, things were going on and he wound up committing suicide in 94, but the Cecil has a history of murders, and God knows what's taken place within all of those walls. There are some real facts here that don't make sense. First off, this video should be required viewing. And Jeff, I think this is something I know that you're going to post this in the upcoming week on in the Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry Facebook group, because this video has to be seen to be believed. But Alyssa Lam made her way up to this water tower. Now, have you seen the water tower?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And let me just say one of the things, I don't mean to interrupt you. One of the things that's interesting, and we will post the video on our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry page. There is a very large belief that the video that has been presented that is out there for public consumption has been edited. And there's
there's
a question. Was it edited to protect somebody? Was it edited because, oh, maybe there was somebody who, you know, walked across the screen that had nothing to do with this and they just wanted to, you know, not, you know, subject that person to anything. And that's completely understandable. But they won't say why it was edited. And that makes it even weirder.
Yeah, and they won't. And the question is, why won't they say it? Exactly. You know, who are they protecting? And I think the theory at this point is that it was edited to protect people that were innocent, that they shouldn't be on that video. But at the same time, so here's the question that I have with this whole thing. And I know that there's a lot of theories, and I can't wait to hear you talk about the theories, because I do get a kick out of when some of these theories are presented. But at the end of the day, Alyssa Lam, I don't know, 110 pounds at max, 115 pounds, apparently gets into this water tank, removes the lid. When she's found completely naked, but her clothes are in the water tank with her. However, the lid to the water tank is completely closed, meaning she would have had to have climbed in and closed the lid, which being it's apparently a heavy lid, 60, 70 pounds, something like that. How is a 115-pound, 21-year-old girl going to close a lid like that? How does that happen?
Well, and one of the beliefs, if you watch some of the theories on that, is that, you know, she may have been in the midst of a manic episode. She lifts this lid. She comes out of the manic episode. She's inside the tower, and she realizes there's not enough breathing space to sustain her, and she can't – she now at this point is inside the tower and cannot – she does not have the strength to lift the tower door open. That's one of the theories that's offered amongst quite a few others. So there's a question as to whether or not this death was self-induced, whether this was a suicide, you know, or maybe she was, again, like in a manic episode, was it accidental? There were no drugs found in her system. She was not injured. She hadn't been sexually assaulted. She was on different medications, as Barry said, for her bipolar episodes. Apparently, though,
can I interrupt you right
yeah,
there?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So apparently, so the not being sexually assaulted is the prevailing theory with it. However, there was blood that was pooled up in her anus. And that's not a reference to a planet. Literally, there was blood that was pooled up in her rectum. However, they say that that could actually occur because of the bloating that had happened with her being, pardon me, in this water tower for several days. But they say there is a slight possibility she may have been sexually assaulted.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, the belief was the medication she was taking for her bipolar problem may have induced psychotic or hallucinating episodes, which I always find, boy, talk about a Hobson's choice there, Barry. You're bipolar. Hey, you know, take this medication. It's going to help your bipolar problem, but you might be turning a little psychotic or suicidal. That's what they call it, you know, the Hobson's choice right there. Now, one of the things that makes this even more fascinating, as if you know, you're not intrigued enough by this, is in 2005, which would have been 8 years before this, there was a movie that came out called Dark Water, which stars one of our friends of the show, one of the people we've talked about, Jennifer Connelly. And Jennifer Connelly was in this movie called Dark Water. Barry, have you ever seen this movie by any chance?
I've never seen it. I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
So Dark Water is about a woman who checks into a cheap hotel in Los Angeles with her daughter, who ends up drowning in a tower on top of the hotel. How stinking freaky is that? I mean,
and this is prior to the Alyssa Lamb case?
Yeah, this is 8 years before.
Wow, that is freaky.
So let me just give you just to wrap up this particular member of our top five, a quick timeline. So January 26th, she arrives in L.A. She was due to check out on the 31st of January of 2013. The video is released on the 14th of February. She's found dead on the 19th of February. The 21st of February, the police rule her death accidental drowning, with bipolarism being a factor in that. Again, the question though is, how did she get in the tank? After she was examined by the coroner, they did their report. Here's another thing that's interesting, Barry, is on the 15th of June, they ruled her death an accident. But then 3 days later, on the 18th, they changed the ruling on the coroner's report to undetermined. So, like, what's going on there? So now, Barry, you mentioned there's a great link on YouTube called Top 5 Theories to the Alyssa Lamb Disappearance. Barry, do you want to talk about it real briefly?
No, well, go for it. Yeah, I'll chime in. But, I think it has to be discussed.
So what's great is, you know, you listen to these Top 5 Theories, and there are some that, you know, very relevant. They talk about, you know, the issue with her manic behavior, that she had been extremely depressed. Then you get into the stuff that's a little bit out there. They discuss the connection with the potential influence of the Illuminati. And that's
the Illuminati. And here's why does the Illuminati target Alyssa Lamb?
Well, there's an answer to that question on the video. Okay. Barry. They say that Alyssa had a, I believe, an Instagram account or whatever under the name Lamb Alyssa. Her only friend was a guy who worked for the government. And apparently they did some research, and there's some sort of government office of all the places in Los Angeles. This office that a lot of people think is a front for the CIA is located in the Cecil Hotel in the middle of Skid Row, Los Angeles. I have no idea why. But the really fascinating thing, and I'm saying this really tongue-in-cheek, folks, is wait, because I'm going to post this video on the theories about Alyssa Lamb. Wait till you get to the part where they discuss the possibility that what Alyssa Lamb, because, you know, there are people out there, Barry, that have far more time than you and I do, that go into extreme detail on the little minutia of all these different cases. So apparently people have gone and watched the video of her in the elevator. And I mentioned she starts pushing all these numbers as if she's trying to escape with people. Okay. And that's the probable, you know, cause, or maybe she was having a manic episode. No. It gets more complex because someone else believes that what was really happening was that Alyssa Lamb was playing what is called the elevator game. Oh, what's the elevator game, Barry? This is so awesome. The elevator game, according to this video, states that you get on an elevator by yourself on the first floor. You press the fourth floor. You go to the fourth floor, the door opens. If no one's there, you then proceed, and I'm getting the numbers wrong. And it's like you proceed to the seventh floor and the 10th floor and then back down to the eighth floor. There's all kind of, you know, confusing lyrics. And then apparently if you follow the steps of this game, if you get to a certain floor and the door opens, a mysterious woman will come into the elevator. You are not to address this woman. You are not to look at her. The door will close. She will take you to another floor. You will then, the door will open. You're again not supposed to address her. You're supposed to step out. And if you step out, you're in another dimension. But you're in another dimension by yourself. I don't know why you'd want to go to another dimension if you were by yourself. And that she was playing this game. And somehow, in the midst of playing this game, she ended up at the water tower. The water tower that, by the way, was locked. And the roof door was locked, which... the elevator game, Barry, I just love the elevator game. That's just the craziest theory.
It is. And some of these theories are absolutely nuts. I mean, if I was to look at this, and again, there hasn't been a lot released on this. It's like there's some sort of, something is secretive about this. But at the same time, based off of the facts that we've been able to see with this, I feel looking at the video, looking at the facts of her in the water tower, I feel that she was either sexually assaulted and then somebody killed her, and somebody, whether they were trying to sexually assault her, physically did sexually assault her, either way, she wound up dead. She's in a water tower. Somebody put her in that water tower. She did not climb up there. She did not remove the lid, get into the water tower, take off her clothes, and then close the lid. It just couldn't have happened.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a initial supposition was that it was maybe someone who stayed in the hotel who was a resident or a hotel worker who had knowledge of the way the roof worked, had access to, you know, get a key that unlocked the door to the roof, that had a key that unlocked the lock that's on the water tower on the roof. It's just absolute craziness. This is one I could watch these videos over and over again because it's just such a mystery. And to think that it's been over 5 years now, Barry, that it's happened and they've come up with no better, you know, alternative solution as to what really happened to this woman. So, yeah, so that's been 5 years. However, you want to talk really crazy. We talked Jack the Ripper. We don't know what's going on him. 130 years ago, 40 years ago, the first, I want to say, Barry, you think the first well-known serial killer in this country was a gentleman who identified himself as the Zodiac. And the Zodiac is our number one in our top five unsolved murders and mysteries. Wow, is this a creepy story, Barry?
Yeah, it really is, too. So this is such an interesting story. And you think about, hey, there was the fantastic movie that came out, you know, what, a decade ago with Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo. But there have been several, you know, movies based off of this. And this really was, you know, you go back to the serial killers of this country and the Boston Strangler and Richard Ramirez. But the Zodiac was one that really captured the attention of the United States. And I was young at the time, as you were, you know, when this was actually happening. And a lot of our listeners probably weren't even alive at that stage. But so I never realized the impact. But apparently, in the research and the reading that I've done, people every night were watching the local news to see what the latest news on the Zodiac was. And I'm talking outside of Los Angeles or outside of L.A. where all this was actually California, where all this was actually occurring.
Barry, excuse me. It was in San Francisco. I don't mean to correct you.
That's why I corrected myself when I said Los Angeles, L.A., and then I finally just said California. It was in Vallejo and the lake that is up there. But, you know, people in Florida were actually watching the nightly news at 6 and 11 in order to see what was happening. And part of that, I think, was based off of the communication that the Zodiac was having with the media.
Yeah, he was basically taunting the media, taunting the police. And a little background for those that are outside the country and are unaware, but it's a very famous case. He has seven victims that are known. The seven victims were all between the ages of 16 and 29. He would send taunting letters signed as the Zodiac. He would send the police cryptograms that he claimed that if you broke the cryptogram, if you broke all four, they would reveal his identity to him. So obviously someone that's doing cryptograms, Barry, is a very intelligent person, knows what he's doing. There is only one of the cryptograms, by the way, was solved. The other three were unsolved. There is a belief that the Zodiac claimed that he killed up to 37 people, although the police will only give him credit for seven. Now, the police currently list the case as inactive, but I'm going to get to that at the end. The first killing was a young couple that was shot on the 20th of December, 1968. Then 7 months later, on the 4th of July, 1969, two people were shot. One lived. The 27th of September, 1969, absolutely horrifying depiction of this particular incident in the movie Zodiac, where a young couple is out on a picnic by a lake outside of San Francisco. They're approached by a man who's wearing a hood with a Zodiac symbol on it. He proceeds to tie them up and then begins stabbing the couple while he's laughing, just completely horrifying. And then on the 11th of October of 1969, there is a cab driver that is shot in the back of the head. The gentleman that's in the back seat that is reported to have done the shooting then exits the cab. There are three people in an apartment across the street who see him exit the cab. He walks away from the scene. The gentleman, somebody is stopped literally two blocks away as the police are coming to the scene. A person is stopped, a white male is stopped by the police. However, the initial report went out. Tell me if you've heard this one before, Barry, that it's a black male. So they let the guy go. Oh, yeah. And, you know, of course, after the fact, they're like, wait a minute, how did that happen? You had somebody and you'd stopped them. And yeah, so kind of screwed the pooch on that one, needless to say. So, but what makes this even more chilling is that there is a belief that the killings may have gone back to June 4th of 1963. You know, so this is a period of time. Now, again, one of the things is, you know, he claimed to kill, I believe I said 37 people. And there's a belief by some in the police that this guy basically was taking credit for deaths that he had nothing to do with, but it was a part of him just attaching himself for the quotation fame and, you know, the rush of being identified as the killer. So they don't know if he had anything to do. One of the things, though, on the 22nd of March of 1970 in Highway 132, which I believe is outside of Stockton, and there was a woman named Kathleen Johns who was driving. She had a man. This was depicted in the movie, and we discussed this in our creepiest scenes another episode of this show, where she is pulled over by a gentleman who is flashing her lights, says he notices that something's wrong with her tire and that she needs to get it repaired. And he says, I'll take a look at it if you want. And so he goes and he's messing with her tire. And he says, okay, I think you fixed it, but you need to go to the next town and you need to pull into a service station because I think you need to have your tire changed or something along those lines. The woman gets back in her car, drives away, and within 30 seconds, her wheel falls off. And the guy is there, oh, my God, I told you something was wrong. Oh, hey, how about if I give you a lift to the next town? He then proceeds to drive her around for an hour and a half, Barry, before she escapes. She's got a small infant child with her. She's able to escape. She goes and hides at a police station. The police station, they know about this killer. They are so concerned and freaked out about the fact that this woman may have had an encounter with a Zodiac killer. They tell her to go stay in the building next door. They don't want her to stay. It's like, I guess they thought Arnold from Terminator was going to drive his car through the police station. Well. But that's how freaked out all the locals were. Even the cops were freaked out by this guy.
Yeah, definitely, too. So let's go back to the first official murders that occurred, not the possible, which I believe was Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday, if I'm correct.
I believe so, yes.
Do you realize that was their first official date that they were on that night?
Yeah.
When they were killed by the Zodiac? That was their first date. I've had some shitty first dates, Jeff, and we can certainly talk about these. I have one that I could tell you that you wouldn't believe, and I know that you have as well. But really, I don't think we've ever had a first date as bad as Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday did.
No, I think that's pretty much a given. You're right. We could do a top five, Baldwin and Barry top five worst first dates. I think we're down for that. It would certainly be a little bit funnier than this episode. So, but what happens is, on the first day of August, 1969, the letters to the editor start. He sends it out to the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner. I believe he also sends it out to the paper in Vallejo. I can't remember what the name of that paper was. So he includes one-third of a 408-symbol cryptogram, which he claims contained his identity. He also made reference in the letter to the movie from, I believe it was 1932, called The Most Dangerous Game. And in the movie, The Most Dangerous Game, the reference there that the most dangerous game is man and hunting man. It was a movie about a guy who got these people on his private island and would hunt them for sport. So then on the 8th of November, he sent the second cryptogram to the papers. That cryptogram to this day, Barry, it's like 50 years ago, and they've never solved this cryptogram. They've given it to the military, and no one has been able to solve this cryptogram. How freaky is that?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty freaky. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of these cases. It's funny because, you know, the belief is that, you know, according to Robert Graysmith, Robert Graysmith was a cartoonist for the, I believe the Examiner. And, you know, he was the character that was played by Jake Gyllenhaal in the Zodiac movie, by David Finch. And, the guy that was identified by Robert Graysmith in his book is a guy named Arthur Lee Allen. Now, most people that theorize on who the Zodiac was seem to primarily identify Arthur Lee Allen as being the most likely suspect. There are some real out there theories that, you know, again, if you go on YouTube, a top five or top 10 guys suspected of being the Zodiac killer. Of course, there's the goofy reference that what's the guy that ran for Ted?
Ted Cruz.
Fred Cruz was the serial killer, even though Ted Cruz apparently was born in 1970, which was like, right. You know, so he's had to be some kind of shapeshifter there to be able to do that. But in 2007,
a shapeshifter. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in 2007, Arthur Lee Allen was again identified as the most likely suspect. He had died subsequent to that. But in 1971, a friend of his had told the police of Allen's conversation where he spoke of a desire to kill people and use the name the Zodiac. It's a little spoiler alert, do you think, Barry?
I think it absolutely is, too. Yeah. So, hey, I want to throw this out there, too. So we just talked about Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday being on their first date. So the second victims were Darlene Farron and her friend Michael Magoo. I don't know how you pronounce it. Magal, Magoo, something like that. But what's interesting about this is Darlene Farron was extremely popular, apparently, and was working at this very, very popular restaurant in Vallejo. She was 22 years old. She was a mother and a wife. So she was and nobody said this, but she was obviously having an affair. She picks up this guy, and they're parked at midnight, you know, out in the middle of nowhere in Blue Rock Springs Park. So, you know, so she's having an affair with this guy, and that's when this thing, you know, this was the famous scene in the movie too, if you remember, where the driver gets out, they shine a bright light, and then the guy who's sitting in the car says, "Oh man, we didn't know who that was," and then he gets shot, and then she gets shot multiple times. But this guy actually survives. The guy that she was with actually lived. The woman died. Darlene Farron died.
Yeah, and you know the crazy aspect. I don't know if it was Darlene Farron or if it was the first woman you mentioned, Betty. What was her name again?
Betty Lou Jensen.
Betty Lou Jensen. But if you recall, and I know this is a complete work of fiction, but if you recall, in The Silence of the Lambs, one of the things that Hannibal Lecter told Clarice that she should identify is figure out who the first victim is, and serial killers always hunt what they see or what they know. And there was a belief that, getting back to Arthur Lee Allen, that Arthur Lee Allen lived down the street from, I can't remember which one of those two women it was, but he basically lived down the street and he had visited the restaurant that she lived or that she worked in. Arthur Lee Allen was a guy in 1968 that was convicted of sexual misconduct. In 1974, he was convicted of lewd act on a 12-year-old boy. He did a 2-year stint in state prison. That was during a period of time, obviously, when I don't believe any killings were going on. So here's what's really crazy. Arthur Lee Allen, as a suspect, again, I mentioned that he was sort of the lead suspect within the San Francisco PD, I think. There was some police work that was done, I want to say somewhere in the neighborhood about 8 or 9 years ago, that basically debunked the theory of Arthur Lee Allen based on some DNA evidence. So they said, no, he couldn't have been the guy. That's when all these other people came forward. There was a guy who identified his father as being the killer. I believe his name was Steve Hidal, who identified his father, George Hidal, as possibly being the Zodiac killer. He also claimed that he may have been the person that killed the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short. So apparently he was getting around California, that guy. So, but what was interesting is here we've got a case, Bear, that's almost 50 years old. March of 2018, they come up with additional DNA evidence that refutes the 2009 or 2010 report. And suddenly, boom, Arthur Lee Allen is back in tow as the number one prime suspect of being the Zodiac killer. This was a guy who had been in the military. He had access to the military supplies, the boots that the Zodiac killer wore. And, you know, the thing is, it's one of the things that's really fascinating. You talk about how this killer and these murders got into pop culture. Barry, you, of course, remember the original Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood.
Oh, Scorpio, baby.
Scorpio. And that's who Dirty Harry was. He was killing. He was after a serial killer. And what's interesting is in the movie, the Scorpio killer, he stops and kidnaps a school bus full of children, which is something that the Zodiac killer threatened to do. So here they were incorporating. Now, meanwhile, what's interesting is all that was happening, the Scorpio guy was basically riffing on the Zodiac killer. And this is while all these crimes are still going on. They're making this movie, which makes it just extra creepy. But it was a great movie, Barry.
You know, it really was a good movie, and you brought that up too. And we also brought up the director, David Fincher. I don't think he's ever made a film that wasn't great. So here's something interesting. Jeff, you know that one of my greatest hobbies is just doing research. And I do a lot of research when it comes to professional wrestling. If I've been posting all this Hulk Hogan, you know, in like fifth grade this past week, just from going. So I put in this morning as I was doing, I put in Darlene Farren, who was the second of the killings. And I put in Darlene Farren, 1969, and I pulled up the Los Angeles Times from August 12th, 1969 on a Tuesday. The headline on the right side says, coded letter says, killing is fun, tells of three victims, and then it's based out of Vallejo. It's strictly about the Zodiac. This is the coincidental part. To the left of that, people see copycat killer in slaying of Los Feliz couple. Similarities noted with Benedict Canyon murders, weird ritualistic overtones, words written in blood. That's the Charles Manson murders. They hadn't put the Sharon Tate and then the Lino and Rosemary LaBianca murders together yet. So they were just starting to piece it together. But how odd and coincidental, and it is nothing more than a coincidence, obviously, but how coincidental that at the same time that the whole thing was happening basically in Northern California, in San Francisco, Vallejo, and the surrounding areas, all the Charles Manson shit was taking place down in L.A. The same fucking time.
Not a good time to be living in California, apparently, huh, Barry?
No, not a good time. I'll post this, too, in the group so people can see it. It's pretty fucking odd, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So anyway, all right, folks. So we hope you will avail yourself of the opportunity to check out some of the stories that we've talked about here. We hope you like this sort of different take from Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. If you like the stories that we presented here, you found them kind of interesting, I would appreciate it if you go to our Facebook group and leave us a little note. Tell us that you like it, or stick with something else. We don't like it. I really like to know, because, you know, if you like it, we'll do another show down the road a piece with the same topic, because Lord knows there's other stories out there. You know, we talked to Brian Last about this, and Brian Last, what did he I tell you? He mentioned Barry as his favorite unsolved case.
You did tell me too. Just my short-term memory loss always fucks me up. What was it?
Hijacker.
Oh, Jesus Christ. How do I forget? D.B. Cooper, absolutely.
D.B. Cooper. That's the one Brian wanted to talk about. But, you know, he thinks he's a big deal because he's a producer. No, we're not going to talk about it. But maybe on the second episode, if the people say they'd like to hear more, we can talk about D.B. Cooper. We can talk about things like that. Here's something I like, Barry, is, you know, we put it out there that we're going to do this. And another episode that we could do is our friend out in Australia, Robert Kajian, says, I'd love it if you guys did an episode where you talked about the Bunyip. And I said to myself, what the hell is the Bunyip? Barry, I did a Google search on the Bunyip, and the Bunyip apparently is some sort of mythological creature in Australia. He's said to be an amphibious monster that inhabits the inland waterways. And so I started thinking, you know, you think about it, every area of this country and apparently in different countries has their own particular sort of urban legend that is only in that area. You know, Barry, you and I were talking about this, and you remember the skunk ape here in South Florida. And, you know, I talked about the chupacabra up in New Jersey, they have the New Jersey Devil. It's not just a hockey team. It's actually a mythological creature that lives in the forest in New Jersey. Every area has got some sort of creature that apparently is only in their part of the country. It's the weirdest thing. And so maybe we can do an episode on that, Barry.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun too. And actually, there is there's an unsolved mystery that has a championship wrestling from Florida connection, which was the murder of Corsica Jean in 1992. So we can talk about that as well.
And that would be a great story. So as we're wrapping up, just a couple quick thoughts here, Barry. I know your son Zach went out and saw Lehigh University. You want to tell the folks how that went? How did Zach like Lehigh?
Zach is such a positive kid, and he and I are always like, you know, the fucking earth could be burning down around us, and we're like, you know, everything's fine, you know, everything's fine. Let's go get some sushi. We'll be fine. You know, we're always positive. So he loved going to Lehigh. I think he's seen 14 colleges and universities so far. We have another trip to Boston scheduled this upcoming week. And then we're going back down to D.C. We're going to see Emory University when we go to your daughter's wedding in October, Jeff. And then over the summer, we're going to see the University of Florida as well when we're down there on vacation. So he's not in a rush to make, but he's loved every university and college he's visited so far. So Lehigh was great. I do believe if we're keeping track on the scoreboard right now, American University in Washington, D.C. is still the leader. He just absolutely just fell in love with that university.
All right. So you're right. My daughter's wedding is coming up in October. I was up there this past weekend doing a little wedding planning with my wife and daughter. I want to give a couple quick shout outs. Mom and Dad celebrated anniversary 67, Barry. Can you even imagine being married 67 years, for God's sake? Happy anniversary, Mom and Dad. Wanted to say
happy
that.
Happy anniversary.
Absolutely. Barry, you know, got me thinking. Barry, do you remember, what was your wedding song at your reception? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. It was something super fucking cheesy, which I guess they all are.
Of course.
Of course. It was, we had, I think it was, which makes no sense, it was Let's Stay Together by Al Green, which is a great song, but I think it's about a couple that's having issues, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what
mine
was.
Mine was, I actually heard it on the radio, that's why I thought of it. I heard Color My World by Chicago, yes. And the reason we chose Color My World is because my wife said, you picked the shortest song, because my wife hates being the center of attention. So she goes, I want a quick 2.5-minute song. Boom, we're up and set back down. So, but a special 67th anniversary shout out to my parents. I'd like to offer a shout out to my good friend, Gabriel Daigle. I'm going to tell you why, Barry. You know, we post all the video links and we talk about the matches from the past. And I got a real nice note from Gabriel, who I don't think I've seen Gabriel since like 90, 91. He came to the pay-per-view in St. Petersburg that was Flair and Fujinami. And so Gabriel sent me a note and said, you know, because of your show that I've started listening to, and what took you so long, Gabriel, he said he started watching some matches from the past. He started watching some of the Japanese matches, and it's really reinvigorated his love for pro wrestling. So I'm always happy to hear that. Want to give a special shout out. Barry, you posted recently Telly Bistis, I believe that's how you pronounce the name, who found the trove of photos from yesteryear. Tell us real quick about that.
But is this a great fucking story or what? So he contacted me, Telly, and Telly's a reporter for a news station in Houston, Texas. He's also a lifelong wrestling fan, and he was having brunch in the Heights section of Houston with his girlfriend, and she said, after brunch, let's go hit this antique store. They walk over to the antique store, and he starts going through a whole bunch of newspapers, and I guess they're 100 and something years old, and he's going through, and there's this briefcase underneath. He opens up the briefcase, and what's inside? Thousands of professional wrestling photographs going back to the 1960s up to the early 1970s. So he cuts a sweet deal. I mean, when I tell you he got a sweet deal on these, he did. Took them home, but he wasn't sure who a lot of these guys were. So he contacted me and he goes, would you mind posting these photos so we can try to ID these guys. So once I cleaned up the mess for myself, because I was so excited when he said that, we started watermarking them, and we're putting them online, and we just started doing it. I'm actually going to post a bunch in the group that are not from Florida. They're from Houston, Texas, and they're just fantastic. Some of these photos are professional. It's obviously a guy who is sitting either ringside or right around ringside. Some are a little farther back, but these have never been seen in the 40, 50, and 60 years since these photos were taken. Nobody's ever seen them. So I'm real excited that he reached out to me, and I'm definitely going to post a whole bunch in the group.
Of course, the inevitable question has to be asked is, did they have the Mike Lano watermark on them?
Of course they did. Because yeah, Mike has been shooting since the Civil War. So you will see the Mike Lano watermark on them. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, finally, before we go, yeah, because we are a podcast that talks about all kind of pop culture. I want to just tell you, Barry, I don't even think I've told you this. Watch last night the Liam Neeson movie, The Commuter. Have you had a chance to see that?
No, I don't think I've ever even heard of it.
The Commuter is, it just came out last year. It's the one where he gets on the train and the woman makes him the offer with all kind of money, but he's got to find somebody in the train. Anyway, I give it a thumbs up. It's a quick popcorn movie. Half an hour after you're done watching it, you're going to forget about it, but I just wanted to say that. Now, finally, in closing, we talked about the recent deaths we suffered in the wrestling world, Johnny V, Bruno Sammartino, Paul Jones, as well as the other people, Barbara Bush, Vern Troyer yesterday. There was one that hit especially close to home to me and to Barry here at Breaking Kayfabe, and that is the death recently of Arlie Ermey. Arlie Ermey, so famous from Full Metal Jacket as the drill instructor. So we'd like to leave you a little different than we normally do here on Breaking Kayfabe. We're going to leave you with a little tribute from Barry and I to the memory of the great Arlie Ermey. Brian, take it home.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor. From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Sir, yes, sir.
Bullshit, I can't hear you. Sound off like you got a pair.
Sir, yes, sir.
If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You are the lowest form of life on earth. You are not even human fucking beings. You are nothing but unorganized, grabastic pieces of amphibian shit. Because I am hard, you will not like me. But the more you hate me, the more you will learn. I am hard, but I am fair. There is no racial bigotry here. I do not look down on niggers, kites, wops, or greasers. Here you are all equally worthless. And my orders are to weed out all non-hackers who do not pack the gear to serve in my beloved Corps. Do you maggots understand that?